Hello, welcome to the Shut Your Face podcast with your host, me, Bree. I'm super excited you guys are here. Thank you so much for listening to this shit show. This is the second season, and I couldn't be more thankful for all of our guests that took the time to talk to me. It's so freaking cool. Go check us out on Patreon for early access and exclusive content. And then lastly, thank you so much to our sponsors, Bemar Media and Leather and Lights. I kind of happen to know them just a little bit. They're pretty cool. Anyways, let's get on into it, shall we?
Oh, okay. Yeah, because of the podcast. That's cool.
How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you today?
Doing well, thank you.
Well, I'm glad that you are taking a second to do this with me, because you're a pretty busy lady. I guess I'll just go ahead and get right into it. At your barn, and I'm going to say this wrong, but it's Fernway. Okay, Fernway Sport Horses. You don't just concentrate on dressage. You do a little bit of everything?
Well, my primary focus is on, and my passion is starting the young horses. And I have recently, very recently, just cut down to dressage horses specifically. But for the past 12 years, I've been very fortunate to extend that into multiple different disciplines and use a strong, solid dressage foundation, which I believe helps all of them. So,
that, you know, somebody else has kind of touched on that, actually, specifically dressage for all disciplines. What is it about dressage that you think kind of makes that hold true for everybody else?
Well, when it's done properly, the dressage training scale actually is incredibly valuable to building a horse that's working through their body properly. And so, especially like me, I'm very nerdy about biomechanics. And so when you're kind of taking the whole horse and the way their body is working into consideration, that really can transfer into all the different disciplines.
Yeah, you know what, I concur, because actually that's funny that we're talking about this. What is your, like, you know how a lot of people have said, made a big, like, fuss about the reiners and ugly disciplines having a really low head? I could be wrong, so correct me if I'm wrong, but technically in order for them to pick their shoulders up and to get their hindquarters underneath them, their head does have to be lowered in a collected stance. Is this true or not true?
Well, it's really more about having the ability to put your horse where you want them and teaching them how to remain engaged in the hind end and use their back and their core, whether their head is at the highest point or, like in the stretchy trot, for instance, a lower point. And it's about keeping the horse connected and through in their body, regardless of head placement.
Yeah, because I think the general public looks at that and sees it like, oh, God, that's bad, that hurts them. But it doesn't hurt them, neither or hurts them.
Right. Well, and that's, you know, even the best stuff for our horses, it can be harmful if it's misunderstood or asked for inappropriately. I think that's kind of the why I like the dressage, is if you're putting the whole horse in the picture, you know, it's just the same as our equipment and everything else.
Yeah, this is true, because you have a right way to do things and a wrong way to do things, and
yeah,
that's with anything in life. Let me back up a little bit. What initially brought you into the horse world? Did you come in at a young age, or did you just always aspire to, you know, be around horses or have anything to do with horses?
Right. Well, so my parents, before I was born, they actually were really big into the Arabian show circuit. And so they would purchase like 5 or 6 top bred young Arabians, and they'd put them in training primarily for Western pleasure. And they'd go to Scottsdale, Arizona for the big shows. And so when I was born, my father was pretty sick, and they had backed down to more of like the hobby horses, but they kept back a couple of their nicer horses. And so as a very young kid, I got to experience Arabians.
Well, hold on. So what do you think about them? Do you think they're crazy like everybody else says, or do you just think they're really, really intelligent?
I owe them and also my very first trainer, Kay Fontaine, my entire education, because I think both are true. And if you can figure out how to work with a spicier Arabian, chances are they're going to teach you just about everything you need to know.
I believe that, because I think I've always kind of thought they were just really smart and people misunderstood them.
Yes. Yeah. I think there's a lot of validity there.
Yeah. Now, we also kind of, well, we didn't get to talk about it much, but I had messaged you about the new, I want to switch gears here, the new Horse Protection Act.
Yeah.
Have you looked into that, or what are your thoughts on that? I haven't seen much of it, but I saw a little bit of it last year. It like poked out a little bit, but I thought it was only going to be related to gated horses, which, okay, that's cool. But then now here recently, apparently there's been, you know, some uproar about it. It's going to be affecting all horses, all shows, all disciplines, everywhere, except rodeo and speed events, I believe.
Right. So, I mean, I have looked into it a little bit. Very fortunately, me primarily showing through USDF and USEF, they already have a lot of safeguards in check for our horses. So, you know, we have TDs and vets on site, and we already are held to a high standard in terms of welfare. Bless you. And so for us, you know, I really think that there's a high probability our TDs will need to be trained per their standard. So that may change a little bit, but the bigger impact I see is for like these open shows and, quite frankly, where I got started, because you don't have hundreds of dollars to go and learn at a show. And so I think that's going to be hard to manage and make sure that it's implemented in a way that supports our horses and not deteriorate our sport. But in terms of their mission and what I think they're aiming for, I definitely think it's very much so needed, unfortunately. And I wish that more organizations had self-governed sooner, much like USDF and USEF, because I think it's better to be handled at home with our organizations, but it's just, it hasn't been happening, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense because, you know, you're basically saying the USDF has already kind of been implementing this stuff long before, so it wasn't as much of a shock, whereas versus now, it's like, you know, the act is just a shock to a lot of people because they haven't been used to this type of stuff where, you know, places could have been doing some of this prior. Because you're right, I mean, with the hype comes, it's just like they say, more money, more problems. So with the hype, is going to come more some type of backlash in some way, shape, or form, some type of something. So do you think that kind of has anything to do with why it's being, you know, brought up now and being enforced more regularly now?
You know, that's a wonderful question. And I honestly, you know, not being a show organizer and not being very, like, I'm not personally showing in those, I can't speak for, like, has anything there changed? I know our discipline is under fire, and rightfully so. You know, to have Olympic-level horses that should be the epitome of what we're all training for, with their tail swishing the whole ride and with their mouth just wide open, and, you know, that's, for me, that's a hard pill to swallow. So I think even like for us, where we are supposed to have judges and TDs who are looking for the welfare of the horse, it's definitely, we're under fire and rightfully so. So it's so hard because something needs to change. I just fear the financial implications because, you know, showing at a rated show is so much more expensive than your open show at home or your local show. And so that's my biggest fear, is those things come with a pretty hefty price. And it's, I just don't want it to make it where we can't afford, like my daughter, she's ready to start on a little local level and figure out what discipline speaks to her. And will we be able to afford to do that? That's the biggest, you know, fear for me, I guess.
Yeah, I didn't think about that, because you know what? That's probably is why the USDF has been implementing it longer than other disciplines, because you guys don't, it's not like you don't have Western horses at an Olympic level. You have dressage at an Olympic level. You have the jumping at an Olympic level, but not most of these other disciplines like Western pleasure or even some of the gated horses or stuff like that. So that's probably why they, you guys have been more used to this type of stuff. Now, you just mentioned something. I saw where there was a kind of a big hoopla about that one girl, and the she was an Olympic rider, and she got under some scrutiny for whipping her horse. And then there was something about one with a bit and the blood and the foam. What? Somebody told me that they actually used to add foam, but now they don't want foam. Is that correct or not correct?
Oh, there's all sorts of terrible things that happen, unfortunately. And so there's a lot. And they do have a no blood rule where even, I think recently we had a high-end horse at a high competition who had a scratch on its leg. And it was obvious that it was a previous injury. But regardless, because of that no blood rule, they were eliminated. So, I mean, we've definitely got our fair share of tricks that maybe not so ethical trainers use to help exaggerate the leg movement and the impulsion that's sought at that upper level, and to include, you know, additives in their mouth to encourage foam. And so there's all sorts of rough training practices, even with all the safeguards put in place.
Yeah, and that is sad, because it is, it's everywhere. It's not just with dressage people. It's everywhere. What is with the foam? Why do you want the foam? Explain that to me, because I don't know anything about it. What is it with the foam?
Well, the foam itself is activated when your horse is soft and supple and relaxed in their jaw and in their pole. And so people were artificially creating that with different either like feeds or something stuck to the bit to help encourage the horse to be sucking on it, or to encourage additional foam production and kind of mass.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I didn't know this. I had no idea that this was even a thing. I mean, because obviously I'm not around it. You are. So, but.
That's well,
crazy.
Even people in the sport. Sorry.
No, go ahead.
Even people in the sport, you know, there's certain things that are incomprehensible until you see it. And I think that's sort of what jaded me in my early 20s and moved me out of competition, is I was sheltered by my dressage coach. She was fabulous, and she was ethical and classically trained. And so when I parted ways with her just because of life, it was a big eye-opener for me in some of the other barns and with some of the other practices, because like you, like it was completely incomprehensible because it's not necessary. So it's, I think, I'd imagine it's the same in all disciplines, you know. It's pretty mind-boggling, honestly.
So you grew up showing horses, and then you kind of went away for a little bit and come back to it. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I competed at dressage under Liz Hendricks and was very successful on my personal horse. And then, like I said, when college and life sort of took me away from her atmosphere, I was like, okay, well, now that my eyes are wide open and I see the atrocities that can be in this sport, like, what's even the point? We're not helping horses. If this is widely accepted in many places, like, we're not helping them. And my thing was, well, how can I actually help the horses that I have in training? And my answer was young horses. And if I can help the young horses get in and get a solid foundation that, quite frankly, gives them the skill set they need to deal with the bad people in the horse industry, like, maybe I will have felt like I actually helped one. And so that kind of set me on a 10 to 12 year journey where I just shadowed under different breeders, different colt starters, and put myself in the saddle of as many young horses as I could. And it was, you know, so fun and such a great skill set to have acquired. So, and then now with my two young babies coming in and I kind of wanted to slow down and take care of them and raise them full time, I was like, well, why can't I combine both? You know, because I had sort of hidden in the, just anything that came in, I'd ride it and start it. And it was like, but I do miss dressage, so why don't I just combine the two? And I've been incredibly blessed to just open my business, Fernway Sport Horses, and get some remarkable young warm bloods in. So it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, I always think it's like, it's elegant. It's like dressage is like the pinky up of horse world.
Like, yeah.
You know, you guys are just so, I just think it's so cool. And some of the, I even talked about this with somebody else, how even, you know, your Western riders and trainers, it benefits them so much to switch up and go do something like dressage or hunt seat or just something of that nature, something completely different. And it'll help keep you fresh as a rider because, like you just said, you know, a little bit ago, the basic elements of dressage can kind of take you anywhere.
Absolutely.
So let me ask you about this because I have no idea anything about it. What are the levels of dressage, and can you explain them a little bit to me? I know you have level 4 is like the highest, right?
So 4th level is our last level that's put forth by USDF, and then from there you can kick over to FEI, and so then you've got your 4 levels within FEI, pre-St. George up to Grand Prix, and that's where you start seeing the much higher collective requirements, so you'll start incorporating your tempi changes, your full pirouettes, piaffe, and passage. And the lower levels are really, like, I think any horse should be able to do both training and first level for any discipline because it's simply, like, very basic lateral movements off of your leg, and other than that, your 3 gaits and their purity. So those are really cool. And then, like, what I do with these young horses is USDF has offered a secondary branch, which is geared for young horses specifically, and that kind of encompasses the material classes, which you can take part in. They're 3, 4, or 5-year-old years, and they're just rail classes where they judge the horse's gaits and ability in the sport. And then they also added in the young horse tests, which they're a little bit more forgiving than the traditional USDF tests, so like your 1st, 2nd level, but they're equivalent. It's just you're not marked on each individual movement. So for a young horse, in my opinion, it's very age-appropriate because they can have a little bit of a bobble, and the judge doesn't necessarily need to deduct that horse for it. So it's a great way to get a young horse the experience and the show miles and not maybe be so pressured for perfection. You can focus on things like the proper biomechanics, enhancing the gait to the best of your ability as a rider, and that score will reflect like the judge's opinion of your horse's ability versus the horse they saw that day, because it's hard for babies to be perfect every day.
Right, exactly. Well, they're learning too, so.
Exactly.
So when you start, okay, so you like to focus more on the actual colt starting portion of it, but you also do advanced training up in the levels of dressage too, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So I guess I'm asking, do you agree that the groundwork is probably the most important part before you get into the actual colt starting, or do you think that people have emphasized that more than necessary? What are your thoughts on that?
That's a great question. And for me personally, I want my horse to be solid and have the information that it needs on the ground before I ever get up. It's not that I haven't cowboyed in my day or I'm not willing to, but it's completely unnecessary. And so So for me, you know, if my horse, I might not do quite as much as other people do, but for me, like the basic skill set of a vocal command for walk, trot, canter, halting, and being able to turn softly left and right, if my horse can't do that without me on it, there's no reason for me to believe it's going to be able to when I get up. And I just don't want our first ride to be a fight because, in my opinion, you know, when they're equipped with the knowledge they need and it's a happy experience from the beginning, there's less that you have to untrain once you get to that 30, 60, 90-day mark and you're starting to really ask for some work from your horse. So I just prefer to get some of those basic skills in there before I climb up.
Yeah, because I've seen multiple different discussions kind of about it. Like, you know, like people think that if you do your groundwork great, you're not going to have any type of cowboying to have to deal with. And I feel like you might actually will, depending if you have excellent groundwork, but you could still have a horse that's never had a saddle on its back. So, like, you know, and then you have the very, very old school mindset, like, oh, you don't need to do, just hop on them and let them buck it out, you know. And it's like, okay, well, that actually did kind of work for some people for a while. So it's always like an up-in-the-air discussion on how people feel about it. But I guess maybe it just comes to situational and the horse. Do you think that kind of plays a part in training too, just generally the horse? Because you're working with another thing that has its own brain. And so to not be able to incorporate the idea of situational things that come up, it's not like just a checklist that you can just run every horse through.
Exactly. Exactly. No, I think you're completely right. And that's, they're all so unique and they're all on their own sort of learning curve. And so I can't sit here and say, well, I have a checklist that all my young horses have to do on the ground. No, I'm very active in our training sessions and trying to see like what holes might this horse have or what, you know, maybe one who's spookier, we do more trust building exercises and I make sure I've got recall on them, where one who's maybe a little bit dead, our groundwork may be freshening up a little bit and, you know, taking me a little more seriously before I get up there. So it's all, you know, and like you said, you can do a perfect job on the ground and your first couple rides, they're still going to have their own opinion no matter how perfectly you set the stage for them. So of course that's not what we want, but it absolutely happens.
Right. Now let's talk a little bit. Have you done any type of Western or have you only just stuck to dressage? Did you do anything else growing up?
Yeah, so my very first trainer, she had me do everything from Western pleasure rail classes to 3-day eventing on a very local small scale. And
oh,
so
wow.
I got to do Gymkhana and some little cross rails, and I owe her everything because she really made sure that before she sent me to a dressage-specific coach that we did everything, and she was like, no, this is where you need to be going, is go pay attention to the refinement in dressage, and she was completely right. So I had a lot of years showing my little 5-year-old Arab in our local show scale Western pleasure classes, and yeah.
I think it's so cool to hear that because people get very, I don't want to say discipline snobby, but they get like discipline, like, you know, some people, you'll just hear people say like, oh, well, ours is better than yours, or you do this or you do that, which is all fun and games, obviously, at the end of the day. But, you know, I think a really good horseman or woman has a respect for all of them and like what it, like, they would say what you were saying, like the elements that come with dressage can be applied all over the board, or the other things that you guys do can be applied to other disciplines, and they kind of run in and out of each other. So I don't know. I think that's kind of cool.
Thank you. I really do, too. And it's funny because, you know, like you were mentioning, dressage is good for all other disciplines. Like a huge thing for me, having been in the dressage immersion life and then willfully stepping back out of it, other disciplines are great for dressage horses, too, because like if you take one of these dressage horses and take them out on a trail and, you know, you're introducing flying changes in a bend on a trail, that actually makes tangible sense to that horse as to why we just did that versus going around and around in an arena over and over again. That can, it can burn them out just as fast. And so I think everyone has valuable information, and it's so fun to be finding like my group of people where maybe they don't judge me so harshly that I'm not like, oh, dressage is the only way. Because for me, you know, it's everyone's got a little bit of it right. And I think taking those walls down and the bias towards other disciplines down is what helps us make well-rounded horses, and they're much more fun to ride.
Yeah, I completely concur, because if you stay closed-minded about anything, you're just going to limit yourself. But, I mean, that is the way it is. Yeah. Let me go back to the Horse Protection Act really quick, because I wanted to, like, look it up. It says, it's a federal law that prohibits sword horses from participating in shows, expositions, sales, or auctions. It also, sales too. Oh, wow. It also prohibits the transportation of sword horses to or from any of these events. So is it really about soaring, or is it just about regulating the horse's welfare?
Well, my take on it is that when they originally introduced the HPA years ago, it was specifically for soaring. But my understanding of it is that their kind of first step is to encompass everybody. And then I think as it goes on and as they further define it, it's going to be more aimed towards truly the welfare of the horse. So I think the specific focus on soaring may fall to the wayside, and like you'll see different regulations start showing up, much like we have already for our branch with USDF and USEF, a lot more equipment that's banned. And I think you'll start seeing a lot more of, you know, like, again, we have inspections done at our shows. I think you'll start seeing that become more frequent, and it'll be interesting to see. And I think this is why there's a lot of pushback where there is it's not well defined what their plan is. And so they're kind of like overshadowing all facets of the horse world, and nobody really knows where and how they're going to start zeroing in. But, you know, I think it'll be more towards the whole horse wellness and ethical training and bolstering the education around, you know, shank bits are stronger than snaffles, and, you know, some things that maybe the professionals within their own industries, we know, but we take for granted that knowledge. It's such a working knowledge for us that we don't realize that the person just getting started at home, they don't understand the difference in severity of equipment or the application. And so it's going to force people to become more educated, and it, you know, any change is scary. And it's like, well, how, they have not well defined how and where they're going to start changing rules. So,
well, yeah, because I'm reading it right now, and this was actually initially passed in 1970. So
exactly.
It was passed in 1970, then amended in 76, and then it looks like it's like basically what you said. It initially started for just soaring, which was the gated horses community. Then now it's going to be pushed into other things to include other things, which, you know what, this might seem like a burden now for people that put on shows and the cost, but this is the only way that we are going to be able to grow the industry in a way that's going to keep it substantially higher than what it's been because of the things that you just said. You know, your non-horse person just doesn't know. They don't know. And when your average person sees an animal involved, they immediately want to go to animal welfare, which is a great thing. I mean, I'm glad we have people that care. But like, right, I'm agreeing with what you just said. We need to be able to explain to them that, okay, this bit is not hurting them. This is what we use, you know, except the spur. This is exactly not hurting them. And then have something to help us weed out the bad, you know, the bad apples that you have with anything. But that's crazy. This was actually passed in 1970, and people act like it's new.
Exactly, exactly. And I think it's just that they're broadening their reach.
Yeah.
And it's a little scary because, you know, I have a very good friend who just went in a battle against USDA over a horse that was being imported. And, you know, they were forcing the use of a test that is not a very specific test, and on all of their website and in all of their literature, it's not even the test they should have been using, but because they did, they were adamant, and this test is known for pulling false positives. And so I think as you add overseeing organizations that aren't as directly involved, like USDF and USCF, they're very involved with their competitors. So as you kind of get further away from that personal relationship, it gets really hard to say, hey, this isn't working for us. And so they may implement rules or inspections or vets or whatever they're going to do, and they're not going to, it's not going to be as easy for them to hear how negatively it's affecting us on a small scale. And so that fear, I think, is very valid, and one that USDA themselves is going to have to clarify for everybody. And I think that's a valid fear, but at the same time, it's like we've had a lot of time to figure it out within, and we haven't. And so
very true.
That's kind of where I get stuck, is like we need something, but it, you know, it's very, they're very detached from us, so it's scary.
Well, yeah, and you know what? I'm glad you just kind of said that, because even like, I'm going to say between 2020 and 2022, the like absolute high of Yellowstone and just the actual like Hollywood hype that surrounded the industry as a whole. People think that it doesn't matter, but it absolutely does, and you'll feel it in the next couple of years. You'll see the difference. But at the height of the hype, you could even see on the internet where people would just get, you had just multiple like discussions between non-horse people and horse people, and horse people have a tendency to get like what you, like what you were saying. It's not that we, it's hard for us to explain the norm already, so to turn around and try to educate non-horse people, it just becomes like an argument. It just becomes like, you know, this non-tunnel, this doesn't get anywhere. And I think it's because of what you just said, the disconnect between our industry and everybody else. And it's like when it got to this high where it was like, hey, hi, y'all check out this, and then it become a want and everybody wanted to be a part of it. I think that kind of hurt us in the long run because of that disconnect of not being able to educate people on what exactly we're doing, and just like the simple things, like the snap
right.
dip is not gonna hurt the horse. But again, your average horse person looks at it and goes, that's a piece of metal in their mouth. What are you doing? You know?
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
And it's hard. Yeah, it's frustrating.
It 100% it is.
So before I forget, though, back to your friend. I saw that. I saw that situation. So, all right, let's back up for a second. So she shipped the horse out of the States, correct, and then was trying to ship it back into the States?
No, so she herself is from Germany, and so she was trying to bring a horse here from Germany, and it got held up in quarantine. She got injured, and that injury resulted in a surgery, which can cause inflammation in the body. And this one specific test that was being utilized, it can run false positives if there's inflammation in the body. And so it was a joint involved, and it just was a long healing process for the mare. And again, I'm not too sure on the specifics or really even how much I can disclose right now, but because the mare was undergoing multiple surgeries and the joint was involved pretty roughly, they just couldn't get this one strange test how they needed it. And then there's like two markers on the pyro test, and she was negative on the important one, but then showing positive on the second portion where inflammation can trigger it. And there's a more specific test on the market that, again, USDA says that they use that more specific test. She was negative on the more specific test. And so the fight was just, you know, hey, give my mare the time that she needs to reduce the inflammation in her body, because two of these three results and the one that is important and the end-all be-all is negative. And so they were demanding that the mare get exported, and
I don't mean to interrupt you, but she was she was dealing with USDA and not the actual plane company, but the plane company was being told by USDA. That's why it was like a back and forth thing. Is that right?
Yeah, USDA is the one who is mandating the export of the horse.
Oh.
Yeah.
I didn't know that they had anything to do with that. I thought that would be like just consumption. I didn't think that.
And in terms of, you know, different diseases that they're trying to keep out of the country, that's kind of where their interest comes in. And again, you know, if that's supposed to be their specialty, you just, you know, when you take a unique off-the-wall situation like my friend dealt with, there wasn't, it was like talking to a wall, you know, and there was nothing that anyone could do, even though the vets in Germany and the vets tending to the mare here, they were all saying, stop, like we've got to give this mare time. And so I think it's just no one wanted anything bad to happen to any horse. It's why these rules get in place. But again, when it gets so detached from the actual situation and the actual reality, it gets very hard to make adjustments. And, you know, they're horses. And that's where I say, like, it's never going to be a one-size-shoe-fits-all. And that's going to be what's really hard to have, like, USDA overseeing all these different disciplines with all these different purposes. And it's just, it's going to be very hard to implement rules that don't, that work for everyone, and even harder to enforce them and the training that's going to go along with it. And
her horse is okay though, right?
Unfortunately, they ended up deciding that it had been enough stress on her mare. Yeah.
Oh my God. Are you serious?
Yeah.
That's sad. That's really sad. She has every right to be absolutely livid.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking. And again, you know, no one did anything intentional, and no one wanted anything bad to come of it. But it's just it's hard when the rules are being made so far away from the reality.
Yeah, no, I understand. It's just like I said with this whole, I made a post about the TikTok ban, and, you know, while some people could care less about it, I get it, but you do have a lot of people who have made a living off of it, small businesses that have absolutely, I mean, it's done wonders for just certain, it's for our economy, if you look at the numbers of it. But anyways, you know, they want to ban it, it went to the Supreme Court, blah, 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 long story short. All of the justices on the Supreme Court upheld this law, so now they have to go through other loopholes or whatever. And I thought to myself, you know what, it should be a rule that we have one person under the age of 30 or even 35 within our government, because they would be more in tune with what is actually going on around normal people.
Seriously.
So they should make it a rule to have a horse person that's actually got their feet on the ground at these events or at these barns, or are a little more in touch with actually what's going on. Because you almost look at some of the things they do and go, what? Are you even listening?
Exactly.
So, which, I mean, that's a little weird, too, that they only are going to be applying this act to everything but rodeo and speed events. So that makes me think, okay, well, you don't care about the horse, because there are horses at these events too. I don't understand why.
Well, that's kind of what I thought. I'm like, a time is absolutely a score. I mean, if you're going for the fastest time. So, I mean,
selection. There was this video that was going around on Facebook of this woman. It was a couple of years back, and they were at a barrel race. And apparently she had like you know how you have a shock collar around a dog, but it's not actually that.
Under her saddle pad.
Yes, it was like a shocker thing. Yes, underneath her saddle pad. And it was supposed to, I don't know where common sense left this lady's brain, or anybody that would think that would make a horse go faster, but like, and but the key of the whole thing was, okay, if you make a bad decision, cool, you have the opportunity to fix it. There's a sliver opportunity to go, you know what, I made a bad decision, let me take this off and fix it, well, you won't have to worry about it again. But instead of doing that, she continued to shock this horse while the whole entire arena was trying to stop her. And I was thinking, shouldn't that be regulated? That's just like a dog collar.
100%. Yeah, and that's just it. It's like, you know, at the end of the day, if you're going for the best time, you're going to ultimately be scored by your time. So in my opinion, my humble opinion, it's like a time is still a score, and there's no reason to think people wouldn't be trying to beat it. And unfortunately, when greed and ego get in the way, at what cost? So yeah. For me, there's a little bit of disconnect in why those aren't included, but I guess we shall see.
Right, right. Now, do you also do any type of clinics and things of that nature, like camps and stuff?
Right now, I do not. It's something that, of course, I've talked about, and I think as my kids get older, I'll find more time to do stuff like that. But for now, it's mostly just my clients' horses here and my family.
That's right, because you're a working mom.
Yeah.
That's very cool. And what type of goals or what things do you would like to see for your place out there over the next 3 years, 5 years, even 10 years?
Well, I have dreams of my dream barn, a nice big enclosed arena. And then, of course, you know, if I can ever get to that point, I want to have lots of fields for these babies and then to open up my facility to the public to a certain extent, whether that's hosting clinics or inspections or shows themselves, this kind of a way to give back to the community, because I know how hard it is to operate without those things. And, yeah.
I think I have no doubt that it'll happen. You'll have a big
Thank
old
you.
Heated arena before the end of the year.
Thank you.
Yeah, that'll be really fun. But as far as you only kind of keep a certain number of client horses in, right? You don't necessarily have or do you do lessons?
I have a couple ladies that I've been working with for a really long time. But other than that, I really just, you know, if it's not, I don't know how to say it properly, but if it's not a horse here that I feel like is kind of promoting my vision of the U.S. breeders that we've got, and I guess kind of backtracking to that, when I was in the dressage world in my early teens, you know, it was all import, import, import. And we knew that the best bloodlines for our sport horses came from Europe. And so when I had kind of stepped away from the dressage scene, I was watching and engaging with the breeders here in the United States and their efforts to bring really wonderful bloodlines here for us so we didn't have to import. And I noticed there's like a break in the supply chain, if you will, in terms of getting these young horses from the breeder and into the community in a way that the community needs, because our horsemanship in the United States is really lacking. And so a lot of times you'll see, especially for dressage horses, the market picks up for a horse once they've got a confirmed flying change and a show record. And it's astronomical to get a horse to that level. So, you know, we've got a surplus of horses bred here in the United States that really are top quality prospects. And they're kind of getting failed because you've either got the gung-ho young horse riders who are running them forward as fast as they can go to get maximum reach, or you've got, you know, people who are great at starting colts but maybe not getting them out into the show ring. And so sort of being a one-stop shop for that, where my background has allowed me to have the education to take them from foaling through all their young years and get them under saddle and into the show ring. And so for me, sort of keeping that going where I keep these working relationships with these breeders and getting these young horses the start that they need to fit into the clientele that we have. Because again, they don't, not, the average dressage rider is not set up to take on a 2-year-old colt or, you know, even a 3-year-old filly. It's hard to find the trainer and get the hours. And you'll frequently hear the upper level dressage coaches saying, you know, oh, I'm too old for young horses and I don't do that anymore. And so just kind of being a middleman in that sense. And so if it doesn't really have to do with those or my family right now, I'm afforded the opportunity to be a little selective, I think. And so not so much on the lessons for me. It's got to be, I think I'm needing purpose in the horses right now more than right. anything.
Right. I'm totally picking up what you're saying. And that helps keep your program at a level that you've worked for it to get to. So that's a good thing. I think that's awesome.
Yeah, and I'm a one-man show. It's a, you know, it's a lot, farm maintenance and riding and daily care. So they keep me busy here.
It's a lot. Like, just the, I don't think people realize, just the, like, the basic care of a horse, take out the training and riding part and the extra stuff, just the basic mm-hmm. care could be considered a part-time job, depending on how
oh,
many
yeah.
you have.
Oh,
like
yeah.
feeding and cleaning stalls and letting them out and stuff, just the bare necessities.
Yes.
That's funny how we, you've brought up warm bloods a couple of times too, and how the horsemanship overseas is a lot different than the horsemanship here in the United States. I can gather that. I can concur with that statement just from gathering from the people that I have spoken to that have ridden overseas or came from another area into the United States. They've kind of hit at the same stuff. What do you think it is that we are lacking to not get ourselves up to that level?
I think that we allow people to skip over the sort of nitty-gritty parts of horsemanship and jump right into riding made horses and idolizing competing. And so here, we're not as quick to force a rider to be able to ride. It's more of we facilitate owners coming in and putting them on push-button horses. And, you know, I will say I don't see that nearly as much here as I did on the West Coast where I was raised. But, you know, frequent lesson programs there, the kids
Wait,
show up.
Whoa, pump the brake. You were raised on the West Coast?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay, yeah, we'll come back to that.
Yeah, California, the first 21 years of my life. So, but there, our lesson programs, the grooms would have the horses basically waiting at the mounting block, and the kids would get out of their nice car and they'd walk straight to the mounting block, climb up and take their lesson, and then they'd leave and the groom would cool the horse out and get it put away. And so it's a totally different client base over there that they were catering that to. But again, I think that even here in my lesson program, because I did teach kids while I was starting the young horses, I love teaching and sharing what I know. And so it's hard to talk to the average kid or adult these days about how important that stuff really is. And so unless you're in an environment where you're truly going out to catch your own horse and bring it in and afforded the ability to talk to someone about what an abscess is and what a colic is, you know, all those tiny things, again, I think professionals tend to take for granted because we know and we've got it under control. Those are the things that, like, kind of make you understand the whole horse over just the riding aspect. And we just don't force that to be a part of our riders as much, I don't think.
I think I agree totally with what you're saying, because you're right. It's like we put more responsibility on the horse, whereas the horse is actually more simple than the human. And it's
yeah.
like I've heard people say it multiple times. They're like, you know, I'm not in the horse industry, I'm in the people industry.
Yeah.
It's true, because you are teaching people about horses, but if for some reason it's like everybody tries to make the horse more complicated, where if they would be more simple with it, it would actually help them.
Yep. Yeah, 100%.
But, So that's crazy. Okay, so what made you come? I'm skirting back over to California. I didn't know this. So you were born and raised in California, and then you ended up, how did you end up all the way over here?
Well, my mom had moved out to North Carolina when I was like 17 or 18, and I had visited a couple times, and quite frankly, I was just so fed up with the politics and the, you know, the fakeness of the area in California I was. I just needed like a big, huge change. And I had lost my father and like a year before, and everyone was like, don't make any crazy changes for a year. And so I waited basically a year to the day, and I loaded everything up, and I was like, I am driving as far away from here as I possibly can. And so I spent some time in North Carolina and almost a year in Georgia with a breeder, and then it's just, I keep coming back here. So I think North Carolina is it for me.
That is so cool, because that's funny you say that. They told you to wait a year, because you are right. Like when something traumatic happens, it's almost like you don't, like, now when I'm older, when I was younger, I probably would have done something. I probably wouldn't have waited a year. But, you know, older, you're like, okay, don't make any rational, unrational decisions right now. Just soak it in and work with it. That's pretty good life advice.
Yeah.
Yeah, it works well.
It works well.
That's cool. So do you know, or are you familiar with everything that the area that with the fires and everything that's going on? Are you familiar with that area or no?
Very vaguely. I was up north just outside of San Francisco. So,
oh,
I mean,
got you.
Yeah, so it's a pretty geographically far away, but Northern California has tons of fires also, and so it's so stressful to see the horse community, and it just, my heart goes out to them, because it happens so fast, and a lot of times, you know, just even trying to figure out how to get yourself in order, and then we feel it here a little bit with the hurricanes, having to make sure that your horses are well cared for, but I think the fires just move so much faster that it's scary.
Yeah, all of that was all very scary, because it's like, and then the news got into the politics of it. They got into the whole, like, how, you know, the governor apparently shut the budget off or something, and then the water, they didn't have any water and all kinds of stuff. I mean, you can't believe everything you hear. It's hard to believe everything you hear on the internet, but
even back when I was getting ready to leave California, everyone was saying, you know, they need to be doing more prescribed burning, because we know that we're a fire risk. And so if they would get ahead of it and they would prescribe fires to burn the areas, it's actually proven to improve I don't even know the right word I'm looking for, but it will improve the area in time, and the trees come back stronger, the grass comes back better. And so again, you've got firefighters then in control of it versus waiting for it to happen when you know it is going to happen, and then now you've got loss of life and home. And so I'm surprised that in the 12 years I've been gone, it's still the same story. That part is frustrating and a little unnecessary, I think, because it's not like it's a new thing that the state is dealing with. But they're not very proactive about it.
Yeah, I would. It's sad to watch any of that type of stuff go on. But, you know, to be the mind, to like think to yourself, okay, if that was me, like it would be heartbreaking to just, like I was thinking to myself, I would let my animals just go. I would just have to let them go. And just like, it would break my heart that they wouldn't be able to run to be free. And then just all of the other things associated, it's so sad.
Yeah.
But now you didn't show in California at all. You just did lessons out there and then came to North Carolina.
Well, I had competed as like a teenager, and then.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And so then once I think I stopped competing like right about the same time I moved, I switched over to young horses and lessons only. Yeah.
That's so cool. I think that's so cool how it's just different. I think it's just, it's cool the way that the different coasts kind of handle things, because right now it's got the whole ranch discipline has taken a huge toll. It's grown so much. I'm actually working on stuff with people that do ranch shows out there, and that's becoming a thing. Have you thought about getting into any of those or no?
Oh my gosh, I would love to. I have a couple good trainer friends that I'm always like, let's go like experience this stuff with them. I think it's so cool, and would love to have access to that here, because just it's so fun.
I bet you your dressage horses would do pretty good. I really do.
I think it would be fun and good for them mentally.
Yeah. Do you agree with that? I've said this before. Do you think horses are better around cows or not?
I think it's pretty individual, but I do think, like, I was able to ride for Jerry King for a little while, and he does the cutting, and he kind of gave me mild introductions with, like, cows and horses, and it's like it turns on a part of the horse's brain where they're really, like, thinking for themselves, and that's a part that if that could be implemented in dressage horses, again, because for us, they're just kind of aimlessly going around, like, okay, I guess we're going to go sideways now, and so I think the functionality of it, I that's one thing I would love to learn more about and see more of in, like, my personal horses that I've got. I think it's really cool.
Yeah, I think that it's really cool. So you got to ride with a cutting trainer. How cool is that?
Oh, it was so fun. He gave me some of my favorite little tidbits of knowledge, too.
Do you think the dressage elements are applied in cutting more than what people give it credit for?
That's a great question. I'm not sure that he and I ever had any really, like, philosophical conversations about it, but when I watch his horses go, or when I watched his horses go, they're biomechanically, like, right on point. And so whether he knows he's doing it or not, or the industry does, there's definitely something, there's similarities I see between, like, the reining horses and the cutting horses, the way that they're expected to carry themselves, and again, that sort of dressage-based foundation that we're going for. The horses are just really working properly, and it's fun to watch.
Well, because, I mean, the collection of a dressage horse is insane. It's like, you know, if you look at the way their bodies are collected, it is, you know, you say body biomechanics, but it's like, okay, it's literally almost like a moving machine. I know there's emotions involved,
right,
but it really is like a moving machine.
Yes. Well, and that for me is what's so fun about it. When you help them get all of their pieces in place, and my mare, she's been a little bit slow to develop physically, so I've been playing with her more than really working, and she's just now where she's like, did you know I have all of this power? And it's like, I know. So when you get them in line and when you get them more responsible for how they're carrying themselves, they're just powerhouses, and it's so fun to watch it come together.
Okay, so you just made me think about a question, and I want to know if because this is what I have believed to be right, so tell me if I'm wrong or if I'm right, but the conformation of a horse is going to directly determine the way that they move.
Yes.
Okay, because a lot of people think that, okay, well, they all are going to move the same way, and that's not the case. It's just like people, it's like you can't expect a short person to go out there and play basketball, or you can't expect, you know, a 18-hand warm blood to get down like a cutting horse. And
right.
I think a lot of people assume, they're like, well, you can't ride papers or the genetics don't matter. Well, that is exactly what you are breeding for, is the outcome that's going to do the sport that you're going to do.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right.
Yeah, some people, I don't think they quite understand how that works. I'm glad that, okay, because that's what I thought this whole time. I'm like, okay, well, yes, the horse can move like that, but is it built to support that movement?
Right. Well, and, you know, like, it's funny, I've never been a breed-specific or paper snob myself, because the reality is most all of our horses can and will do any of the jobs that we ask them to. That's sort of the art of riding, regardless what you're doing. But when you start to get more into some of the goals of like some of my owners, you know, then that's when you start seeing the confirmation and it matters. And so the breeders will follow the stallions and what they're known for producing and what they stamp on the mares. And, you know, they know their mares. And so they're absolutely trying to create the most ideal confirmation so that that horse doesn't have to work so hard. And, you know, any horse, again, they can go out and they can be successful, especially with dressage. I would never want to discourage anyone because they're on a quarter horse to go and do dressage. It's wonderful for them, and most all horses can make it up to third, fourth level with proper instruction, even if it's maybe not going to be the one picked for the Olympic team. You could still go and win on a local or even regional level, but when you start really getting to where people are wanting to compete internationally, you know, the U.S. especially is in very young in comparison to our breeding programs for the warm bloods in specific compared to Europe. And so it matters when you're maybe looking at a larger show venue or larger goals for that horse. It 100% makes a difference.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to kind of get into the logistics of the breeding and the genetics and the different animals and stuff, because it's like, it's funny because I agree. I see what you're saying. It's like, yes, they can do it. You might not like it. And it might not be perfect, but they can do it. But it does, the confirmation, the way they're built does matter. And that's just like, we can get into the whole mentality of some people think that it's better. And that's such a weird way to say it, because I think they all matter. I love them all. I would, like, keep all these animals and
exactly.
Be, like, you know, like this little weirdo with all these horses, save them all. But some of them do cost more than others, and it just is what it is. It kind of sucks, but I guess that's the business aspect of it, you know.
Yes.
Change that part of it. But some of them warm bloods are very, very expensive animals, too, like really expensive.
They are. Yeah, and I'm sitting here now looking at, like, one of my clients. He's a 2-year-old colt, and he's marvelous. I mean, when he moves around the field, you don't see a single thing that you want to change about him. Like, you are like, I just want to sit on that, and he's perfect. And then my mare, I'll use her as a great example, because she does not carry herself like a high-end dressage horse. You know, she's a little bit more hunter type and likes to be relaxed and low-key. But her body still has the exact same potential, and conformationally she's very sound. But, you know, just that one little difference there, like that colt, he's going to take so much less to get into the show ring respectively than like my mare. And so, again, it makes it easier for the horse when they're bred for a specific discipline to then step into that easily. And he'll have so much less to learn about how to use himself, because it's easy for him. He doesn't have to overcome any of those maybe conformational differences.
That is very true. That is very true. You just made me think about something. I wonder if there's probably no way to actually do like a market value assessment of horses and breeds, because it's like, you know, if you look at horses the same as cars, which would be very hard to do, but I'm just hypothetically speaking here, you know, you have like a guideline of what the value of something is based off of what it's made, how it's made and what it's got, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So you can kind of like get an idea of what you're dealing with, whereas horses is literally just, you know, like caution to the wind. It's like whatever they say it is.
Yeah, we do have some equine appraisers, and like especially with insurance companies, you'll start to see like with show records and stuff, you can get some of that value sort of proven for you. But really, for me, my best assessment for a dressage horse in specific is their show record. And we're lucky that USDF maintains the database now. But a lot of it is like, it's open to opinion in terms of pricing and getting a fair market value, you know, that it can be challenging to do, especially one that's maybe
change.
Not shown yet. I hope so.
I think it is, because I think with so much hype, like I was saying earlier, with so much hype and eyes on the industry, it makes it more lucrative and more desired. Like, you just brought up horse insurance. Like, back in the 90s and 2000s, you didn't hear of that.
Yeah.
People didn't really, unless it was like high caliber stuff. Nowadays, you have people getting insurance on their horse that, not to say they're not low caliber, they're just a special. I'm not saying it like that, but I'm just saying, in comparison, in the 90s and 2000s, you didn't even think about horse insurance unless you were dealing with some world champion Olympic, like, up there.
Right.
Nowadays, your average Joe Blow can just be trail riding on, again, a nice horse, and go get insurance on it. It's like happening more and more and more these days. People are putting insurance on horses. So there might actually be more of a way to assess the value of horses in the coming days. What do you think?
I think that would be incredibly helpful for everybody. And especially, you know, for buyers, I think you hear a lot of times the trainers going on and on about, like, you don't know how much it costs to produce these horses. And so I think even just that shedding some light on not only the value of the horse, but then what truly goes into it, that would help everyone tremendously.
Yeah, I think it would too. That'd probably be a great thing for all of you guys, because it really has no leg to stand on. Like what you just said, the only thing that people can really stand on is a record, a show record, which is, you know, good, but that can even sometimes be hit or miss with some of these big guys. You've got some of these stallions out there that didn't show not even a year, but they've got millions of dollars of babies on the ground. So,
right.
That's crazy. Look at us. We're just changing the horse industry.
Hey, I'm here for it.
No, I'm just kidding. But it just made me think about when we were talking about this, like, you know what? There really isn't, like, there's not like a website that you can just go in and go, okay, well, I've got this, this, and this. What's it worth? You know?
Right. Yeah. That's a great point. That would be amazing to see come to fruition.
Yeah. Well, with more regulation with the Horse Act and things of that nature, I foresee it's going to be, I guess we can either choose to let it help us or hurt us, but hopefully it'll help everybody.
Yeah.
Well,
100%.
I have already kept you for an hour, over an hour, so I don't want to keep you any longer, but I've thoroughly enjoyed our conversation, and I got to hear your voice. I'm just honored that you talked to me.
No, are you kidding? I'm honored. Thank you so much, and this was so fun.